this morning at 1 and 2 Kings, and I was wondering if anybody knows the outline to 1 Kings, outline and theme of 1 Kings.
Kingdom united, kingdom divided, and then Solomon, like 1 through 12, kingdom united, and kingdom divided, like with his son Rehoboam and on down.
Yeah, 1 through 11, 12 through 22, that's right, very good. And why is it called Kingdom United, Kingdom Divided, Charlie? Say it again.
Well, because under Solomon, well, when he became disobedient, it became, his first 11 chapters, it was united under Solomon.
Yeah.
But then because of his disobedience, it became divided, and then went to his son, and then you had his son versus Jeroboam. And,
right, so after Solomon, you enter into what's called the divided kingdom era. Before Israel had always been united as, if you want to say, a nation or as a people, to begin with under the judges and the theocracy, and then after that under the three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. But then, as Charlie mentioned, after Solomon, his son Rehoboam abused, if you will, his power and caused the northern tribes to rebel under Jeroboam. And so you entered into the divided kingdom era. And so from that time forth, you had a split kingdom. Two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, were the southern kingdom, and then 10 tribes essentially were the northern kingdom. Although the Levites, you know, never had official territory. I'm not sure, actually, how you divide up the Levites, because they would have been in Judean and Benjamite cities. But nevertheless, they didn't normally refer to a southern kingdom as Judah and Benjamin, and the northern kingdom as the other tribes. So that's the division. How about some key chapters here? I'll just ask what happens in chapter 1? Solomon is appointed king. And what happens in chapter 3? Say it again.
Solomon,
this is where God asks him, you know, anything he wants in the world, and he says he wants wisdom. And do you find Solomon dedicating the temple?
Chapter 8.
You guys should read that. It's a fabulous chapter. Solomon, as you may remember, is the one who built the temple. David wanted to build the temple, but God would not let him because he was a man of blood. He was a warrior, and God did not want that to be the legacy of the temple. So it was built in peacetime under Solomon. It was the benchmark of the First Temple era, even though the First Temple era predates Solomon, but he's the one that built the temple, and it was a glorious temple by every ancient metric. And then where do you find the ministry of Elijah?
17.
What happens in 17? And then what happens after that in 18? He confronts the prophets on Mount Carmel. And then after that?
He runs,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, all right. So very good. Appreciate you guys doing that. So this story, or this account, I should say, is teaching a distinction between, if on one hand you might say, a trust in earthly power versus a trust in God, or you could frame it up as the blessings of obedience and the cursings of disobedience in the book. But as you trace through the book, there seems to be a descent into greater and greater chaos and judgment for Israel and for Judah, and much of it depending on their leadership at the time. Under the United Kingdom, David appoints his son in the opening chapter, and everything is going swimmingly, as they say in Britain. Solomon is young, but he is acting with tremendous amount of wisdom, and he brings prosperity to Israel and constructs not only a magnificent temple, but a number of significant cities and strengthens Israel's borders. And this is probably the era of peak Israeli influence, the most glorious that the kingdom ever achieved, perhaps in its history, ever. Of course, we know the story of the Queen of Sheba coming to hear of the wisdom of Solomon because his wisdom was renowned all over the world. He extended the borders of Israel. He made peace treaties with all of their enemies. And yet, in spite of all these things, in spite of the size and the strength and the prosperity and the peace of Israel, it still wasn't the kingdom. It still had flaws in the fact that the people were idolatrous still, and even King Solomon was himself not pristine. And so for all the promises that God had given to David of a coming king who would sit on his throne and usher in an era of peace, you may think that in the opening chapter or two of 1 Kings that Solomon is fulfilling the promise, but it becomes evident after a while that he's not. So you may think of Solomon as the most ideal of leaders that you could have hoped for, apart from a divine leader. He had skill, he was adept and effective in his leadership and brought so much prosperity to Israel, but still was not capable of bringing about the kingdom. And so even Solomon's heart turns away from the Lord in time because of his methodology of establishing peace. Much of it came through marriage. So he multiplied his wives, multiplied even his concubines, and those wives turned his heart away from the Lord. So these treaties, these connections with the other nations led to his disobedience and led to God's judgment in time. So you have, just this visible lesson of how disobedience leads to division and judgment, and how idolatry at a national as well as a personal level turns someone's heart away from the Lord. And it happens under the circumstances of tremendous blessing. And yet, throughout all of this, God continues to affirm his covenant. So he, if you want to think about it this way, he pours out his blessings on Israel in unprecedented measure. Israel, in spite of those blessings, still remains unfaithful to God, and yet God doesn't turn away from them. And this becomes the story of Israel's history from this time on, as you move from a relatively good king to bad and worse and horrible kings. None of it really changes God's plan. No matter what the leadership failures might be, he continues to affirm his covenant throughout the Old Testament. And so the story is about Israel's failure, but more importantly, it's about God's faithfulness to his promise. Nothing that Israel will do, nothing that their leadership does, no matter how despicable and terrible, and it's terrible at times, no matter how bad it is, God is not going to revoke his promise either to Abraham or to David. He made it on the basis of his name. He made it on the basis of his name. He swore by his own name. And so this has really nothing to do with Israel and their worthiness. It has everything to do with God and his integrity and his name. So he's going all the way, we're going through this book. We see Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam, and the issue. Anybody remember what the issue was that caused the harsh split?
What were the,
he didn't listen to the old guys. That's the first problem right there. Yeah, didn't listen to the old guys.
Yeah, you're saying my finger will be heavier than my father's, I don't know the exact analogy.
Yeah, I think my finger will be heavier than my father's hand in relation to, come on, where are my Republicans? Taxation, come on, guys. I'm trying to draw it out of you. Taxation without representation, you know. It always goes back to that, doesn't it? At some point, they needed a Doge back in those days. Although Doge is not able to stop the spending, it seems. They're still going to pass the spending, even though Doge finds the corruption. Anyway, don't get me started. Rehoboam decides that he's going to tax in a heavy way, and the people, of course, rebel. So Jeroboam, which, if I remember correctly, is the cousin of Rehoboam, I believe, sets himself up, establishes himself as king up north and in Samaria, and immediately turns the people away from the Lord. He establishes a new capital, but having been cut off from the temple that Solomon had built, also establishes his own temple with all of its own rituals to sort of make the nation unified under a religion. He didn't want their religious devotion still being in Jerusalem if he was trying to establish a national identity up north. So this initially leads him into idolatry, and then the rest of the kings just recounts the various leaders who come and who do evil in the sight of the Lord. And the writer, you know, notates that the kings were either evil or good in the sight of the Lord. And this, of course, leads to Elijah emerging during the reign of Ahab, and he confronts this immense idolatry and challenges them up on the mountain of Carmel, one of the more dramatic demonstrations of courage and boldness in the Old Testament, when God rains down fire on the prophets of Baal and destroys them all. It's a really, moving thing to be up there on Mount Carmel and be thinking about, because you can see a lot, if not most of Israel, from up there. And just to be able to re-envision what that must have seemed like for him to be calling down fire on all of these prophets with all of Israel sort of visible underneath. He's in that way sort of representing the, sort of representing priestly over the land. But he does that, and of course he runs away from Jezebel, and the Lord teaches him that he still has 7,000, isn't that the number? 7,000 people who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. So even though Elijah felt alone, he wasn't alone. So that's the book of 1 Kings in just a nutshell. You move from there into 2 Kings, which continues the drama of these two nations in their decline and sort of systematically running through the monarchs and their relative goodness or evil. And you begin to get a picture that the southern kingdoms are doing better because they at least had the right temple and they at least had the original structure of the religion. But the northern kingdom with the idolatrous temple had no anchor. And so they were drifting way faster into evil. There were occasional alliances for common enemies, but for the most part, the nations were at war with one another and on a collision course, if not with one another, also with the Lord. So when you get to 2 Kings, it also has a two-part breakdown. Brian, do you remember the two-part breakdown?
I'll try.
Okay.
Kingdom divided, Israel falls in 1 through 17, and then kingdom which survives, many kings, chapters 18 to 25.
All right. Very good. So yeah, you got kingdom divided, and Judah falls, or Israel falls and Judah falls in these two chapters. You kind of break it down that way, but there's woven into all the chapters, there's discussion about both kingdoms. But the fulcrum point is chapter 17 in 2 Kings. 2 Kings 17 tells the story of the Assyrian captivity when God came and allowed the northern kingdom to be overrun by Assyria. Samaria falls to Shalmaneser. Does anyone know the date of that? 722 was the fall of the northern kingdom. Just for a little context, when did David's reign begin? 1,000, more or less 1,000. You can quibble a few years on either side of that, but for the most part, started in 1000, lasted for roughly 50 years, and then Solomon's reign after that, roughly 50 years. So the divided kingdom starts in the early 900s and goes to 722 when the northern kingdom falls. And then the rest of the book, as you move through this in 2 Kings, Judah has moments of reform, particularly under Hezekiah, which is the first, you know, part of that second half of the book. After the Assyrian captivity in 17, 18 through 20 is Hezekiah and his attempts at faithfulness. But at this point, even good kings are fighting an uphill battle because the culture is lost. They might have personal faith, but they're battling an overwhelming debauchery in their culture. And so, you know, even their attempts to bring reform are met with intense resistance. And then you get to Josiah in chapter 22, and he attempts to lead the nation back to God. You want to remember how that unfolded with Josiah? Yes, so the temple had fallen in disrepair. So Solomon's temple now, you know, roughly about 300 years after it was built, had fallen into disrepair. People weren't paying their tithes, so they weren't able to collect, you know, what they call the temple tax. And the temple was dilapidated. So he decides he's going to pour money into restoring God's temple and get people back engaged in worship like they should. And as they're digging through the rubble, amazingly, they find the scroll of God's law, which tells you what? They didn't have a lot of copies, right? They weren't reading this all the time. So this was all tradition. Whatever they were operating under in terms of their sense of religion was at best oral tradition, or written, perhaps written down, but most likely just oral tradition. It was a miserable time as they were operating under the opinions and dictates of men that were supposedly carrying religious authority. So they discover a scroll of the book and read it to Josiah, and he just tears his clothing because he realizes how lost they really are. Very dramatic event, and immediately gets busy with revolutionary reform, goes around, starts pulling down all the high places, which were altars that they had built all over the nation, tearing down their idols, eradicating their priesthood to all these idols. Just major reform. But at the same time, he's a king, and he has enemies, and he's got to lead his troops into battle. And, of course, he does this. There was a major tussle going on between Egypt and Babylon during that time. And Israel was the thoroughfare. They were the crossroads of the world. So these armies were constantly marching back and forth in battle with one another over and around Israel's territory. So Israel was constantly invaded if they weren't a target. But it was precarious. At times they would attack Israelites. At times they would march on through. But for security purposes, Josiah was trying to make alliances with these people. And during one of these episodes, when Egypt was marching north, he goes out to try to stop them, and enormously overwhelmed in terms of manpower, and his army is overrun, and he unfortunately dies. I've been thinking about Josiah recently because I'm studying Zwingli. If you guys know that name, Ulrich Zwingli. He was one of the key early reformers in the 16th century, lived in Zurich, where my son is living. And we're getting ready for this Reformation tour. And Zwingli he preceded Calvin. He was contemporary with Luther, kind of preceded Bucer a little bit down in Constance. But he was only active for 12 years because he led the city in armed conflict against some enemies, and he died on the battlefield. So he's the reformer nobody likes to talk about because he was the reformer with a sword, and all the other guys were more peaceful, if not pacifist. And so it makes Zwingli's life a little complicated, but you kind of have to dive back into that day and that world where warfare was just a way of life. Everybody was expected to serve in the army and to defend their city. And so Zwingli, even though he was initially a priest, but then a pastor, you know, he was trained in conflict. And when your city's being attacked, you were expected to take up arms and go fight. So I always think of Josiah, you know, the fallen reformer. I don't think it's a stain on Josiah's life where he's still well thought of. By the way, this is way more than you probably need to know, but many people think that the Bible was actually written in Josiah's day, that the story of discovering the scroll is fabricated to sort of give a pretext for the institution of Mosaic law and codes. This is the liberal slant, so just so you know. But this whole story about discovering the book of the law was, you know, people decided in the 19th century United States that was not historical. And what the church has always believed about that is not true. And that this was actually a fabricated story to invent the law. There's all kinds of crazy reasons why liberals say that. But the bottom line is, you know, they don't trust the Bible. They don't take it at its word. They don't believe that Israel's religion could have been as old as it is. They don't believe that Israel is as old as it is. So they have all these assumptions and presuppositions that they bring to the text, and then they have to find a way to make the text fit their presuppositions. And so they dream up this story that their true religion of Israel actually started, the Mosaic law, the Deuteronomic law, started during the time of Josiah. Like I said, you're like, why are you telling me all this stuff? I don't need to know all this, but just rattles around in my head. So after Josiah, very quickly, I can't remember when it was that Josiah died, something like somewhere around 610. They give way, 608, maybe something like that. That gives way to the following kings. Jehoiakim, who is a descendant, I'm sorry, Jehoiachin, I think, follows. I can't remember who follows Josiah. Who is it? Jehoahaz, yes. And they loosen up the reforms, the restrictions. Israel starts to slide back into idolatry. They're invaded three times by Babylon. The first time is, I believe, in 605. And then they take some captives. This that was most likely when Daniel was taken captive, when they came, and they didn't take everybody, but they took, if you will, the cream of the crop. They came in and they took the children or the leaders, the what you might think of as the nobility of Israel. That's the educated ones, the ones who, you know, were from wealthier families. So that's Daniel taken in 605, most likely. And then they were invaded again in 598 or 596. And more destruction. And at this point, they set up a puppet king at that point. That puppet king eventually rebels. And then in 586... Babylon comes back and utterly destroys the nation. And when I say utterly destroys, the only thing left were a few sheep herders. I mean, they destroyed every city. They tore down the stones. They leveled the, you know, everything to the ground, so that the scripture says, you know, you could hardly tell anyone ever lived there. You know, you would come in and it would be desolate. Like a hut in the middle of the field, as Isaiah chapter 1 says. Just like you're walking into barren country. And they deported everybody in chains, marched them back across the desert to Babylon. This is, of course, in the time of Jeremiah. They would station them in camps up in Ramah. And then one by one marched them out. Many of them, I'm sure, died on the way to Babylon. But they relocated the entire nation to Babylon with just a few people left over. So the land became uninhabited. No one really came behind them, not in any significant way. They were just Bedouins. Became overrun, overgrown. Uncultivated, wild, farms and agriculture all sort of regressed back to nothing. And this went on for 70 years of Babylonian captivity. This was a significant time in Israel's history because several things happened while they were in Babylon. First of all, they changed their language. Prior to this, they used to use a unique script, sometimes called Paleo-Hebrew. But when they went to Babylon, they adopted Aramaic script. So if you ever see ancient documents in Hebrew prior to the captivity, it would look more like what we would think of as hieroglyphics, something more akin to what you would find in Egypt. Afterward, they use Aramaic script, which is what, you know, if you see a printed Bible, Hebrew Bible today, that's still what they use, Aramaic script. So when they came back from Babylon, they couldn't read. If they had ancient documents, they couldn't read their ancient documents because they couldn't even recognize the characters. Secondly, they had no temple. And so they had to figure out a way to do worship in a foreign land. It's the first time ever since they came to the Promised Land, ever since they, you know, came out of Egypt, got the law, which established, you know, the temple and all the ceremonies, and they went into the Promised Land, and that's all they had ever known. Well, then you get to Babylon, they don't have that. There's no place to sacrifice animals. They can't sacrifice animals. There's no altar. Or temple, or, you know, functioning priesthood. So they established something called synagogues. So this is where synagogues came from. They emerged in Babylon and became a very robust system And of course, today we still have synagogues all over the place. That's how Jews have worshipped ever since. They've worshipped in the synagogue because they've never, well, they had a temple, obviously, in Christ's day, but for the most of their history, they haven't had temples. Even when they reestablished the temple, they still had synagogues. And the synagogues developed a form of worship that drifted, obviously, further and further away from the centrality of the sacrificial system because they couldn't sacrifice. And so they started to add to the Hebrew scriptures explanations of how to be a faithful Hebrew, a faithful Jew. And this added the oral law. This is where the oral law started to emerge, because they had to figure out, what do you do with these scriptures that most of them talk about sacrifices and animals and all this stuff, but we don't have all that. So they started to figure out all kinds of things to layer on top of it to make their religion more robust, and that developed, for the most part, in the Babylonian captivity, or at least it started in the Babylonian captivity. And so that's why they have that. By the way, to this day, you have the Talmud, which is the essence of so many of these oral laws that were originally written down. The Babylonian Talmud is considered the authoritative version. There is a Palestinian Talmud and a Babylonian Talmud. They developed over time in parallel histories. But when you talk to rabbis, Hebrew scholars, they always look at the Babylonian Talmud as the old original Talmud. So significant things happen in this Babylonian captivity that changed Israel forever. And then they come back. Now, one thing I'll end here this morning. The captivity happened in 586. There were three invasions, and they took captives every time, but the captivity, when they took the entire nation, happened in 586. That's significant because there was a prophecy that was given to Jeremiah that God was going to send them into captivity for how many years?
70.
70 years. And so what's 586 minus 70? 516. So if that prophecy is true, you would have expected something to happen in 516 BC. But if you go on down through the history, there were several things that happened. There was a decree from Cyrus for Israel to be able to go back to the land in 536, I believe it was. 538. 538, Cyrus decrees that people can start to go back to Jerusalem, and they start to go back and they resettle, but of course they don't have any city, so they got to rebuild the walls and rebuild the structures. And then there are successive waves of Israelites who go back, but it's not until 516 that they actually reestablish the temple. And it's just a shell of what it was before. They don't have the resources and the money that Solomon had. So they lay a foundation and put up a very crude structure to reestablish the worship of the temple. And the old men who were still alive could remember their younger, perhaps teenage days. Now they're in their 80s. But they had a recollection of what Solomon's temple looked like, and they gathered around and wept as they saw the paltry excuse for a temple that they were able to erect. But that's what happened in 516. So if you want to think about it this way, the bookmarks or the bookends of the captivity in God's mind isn't so much when a few people were deported here or there or a few people came back. It was the temple. It was the destruction of Solomon's temple and the reinstitution of a temple in 516. That is the benchmarks of either side of the 70 years of Jeremiah's prophecy. And of course, it came true in incredible detail, just like God told Jeremiah that it would, like you see over and over again in Scripture, prophecy fulfilled again and again. All right, when we come back next time, we will get into 1st, 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah and Esther. Hopefully we can deal with all that next Tuesday. You guys have any comments or questions as we wrap up?
What was it? Ezekiel, did he go with Daniel or?
No, I don't think so. I think Ezekiel was part of the final deportation. What's that?
The second one.
The second one, okay. Yes. But Ezekiel, Ezekiel is prophesying prior to the destruction of the temple, all really mostly about the destruction of the temple in the city. And then, of course, the second half of Ezekiel's looking prophetically towards the reestablishment of Israel, the reestablishment of the temple. That'll be interesting to talk about when we get to Ezekiel. That's a stumbling block for a lot of people, the reestablishment of the temple in the millennial kingdom. But I stirred up enough controversy in Timberlake. I don't want to get anything going here this morning. All right, guys, thank you for your time. You're dismissed.